Welcome to AZMCast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the reference paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the September episode of AZMCast. So growing up, I would watch ER on TV, and I would think about how awesome it would be to work in an ER someday and save lives, and the music would swell, and I'd do that cool Eric LaSalle kung fu move in the hallway. You guys know the one. So then I got into medical school, and I realized that while there are high highs and low lows in emergency medicine, the bulk of the job is the really simple stuff. It's belly pain, it's headaches, it's sprained ankles and viral syndromes. And yeah, I still feel like I've done something as a doctor when I've tubed, lined, and resuscitated someone who was about to die. But that isn't enough to really get you the fulfillment from your job, because most of what you're going to see is the simple stuff. And that's why we can justify doing not one, but two episodes on something so simple, so mundane, and so boring, like sore throats. We're devoting two podcasts to this because everyone in the ED is worried or scared or just feels terrible, and a lot more good can be done by helping people with their definition of an emergency, even if you don't find it all that cool. So in this spirit, Brian and I are going to try to keep you on board by talking about the dangerous stuff first, followed next episode by the stuff you're actually going to see every single shift of the rest of your EM career with pharyngitis. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. So Brian and I are here again as people from our team are trickling back from vacation and starting to catch up on all the work they've been missing out. We hope you enjoyed last month's podcast on subarachnoid hemorrhage. We are going to do a whiplash turn to quite possibly one of the most boring subjects that we could think of. So boring that we decided to do it when Allie and Chris and Jared were away. Because there's no way that we would be able to get through it. We're going to talk about the sore throat. Woohoo! And now everybody is turned off and they're waiting for the next month podcast, or they've just unsubscribed entirely.
The good thing is I don't think they'll see a sore throat, Aaron. So this is a rare occurrence. We should probably talk about more rare diseases too.
That's true. We should talk about that one time where the magic bullet went and caused a pelvic fracture and an epidural, you know, because you'll see that more. So we talked about this. You are going to see tens of thousands of strep throat, viral, Epstein-Barr, all kinds of, you know, strange pharyngitis throughout your career. Even if you find one of those cushy jobs where you've got a fast track area and everything gets siphoned off, you are still going to see tons and tons of sore throat. So even though it may not be the sexiest thing to talk about, it is bread and butter emergency medicine. So we're going to talk about the approach.
Yeah, these are the things that, you know, upper respiratory infections, they're not sexy. Sore throat, they're not sexy. But what they are is they're a lot of your patients. They're core common things, and you got to be really good at these easy, quick, good assessments, make a decision, and move forward with these patients because your friends have them, the people you treat have them, you're going to have them. So why not understand it and have a good plan and approach to these patients?
So we hope that after listening to this episode, you can hear a friend of yours, family member, talk about the time they went to the local quick center and got antibiotics and then silently judged them. So sore throats are very common. We, being emergency providers, like to talk about the deadly stuff first. But We'll get to that after we just talk about when a patient comes in, we always talk about airway, breathing, circulation. So your sore throat is airway. So I've had every manner of person tell me with fluid speech and not even a hoarseness to their throat, they've told me, I can't breathe, my throat is closing up. And you go, okay, I'll take that with a grain of salt, versus the people that come in with airway obstruction. They don't complain of sore throat. They complain of... That's their chief complaint. So patients that come in with sore throat, we take a little bit of a history. We ask them, have you had fevers? Have you had other URI symptoms? And then we tend to get bored pretty quickly as far as the history goes.
Right. We're grabbing the flashlight and looking in their throat. I mean, within 30 seconds, they said sore throat. I think there's an otoscope in my hand.
Yeah, you kind of go, hi, I'm doctor. Open your mouth. And then we look back and we're trying to see what's going on with their throat. We see some red throats. We see some patchiness. This time of year in peds, I'm seeing a lot of vesicles from Coxsackie virus or non-polio enteroviruses that are causing hand, foot, mouth, or herpangina. So your physical exam, you really can't knock it. You have to be able to take a look well. I'll give you my quick physical exam pearls for kids is there's no better way except to gag these children when they won't open their mouth. And you have to look. I have had plenty of patients get IVs, urine, and other, you know, extensive workups, x-rays, and then I go in because I hadn't seen them yet, and I gag them, and there's vesicles all over the back of their throat. Now you got a diagnosis. So you get that tongue blade in there, you push it in between the teeth, and then you twist it clockwise, counterclockwise, I don't care, but you end up getting it open, and the point is not to open the jaw, it's to get that thing back far enough until you can touch the uvula and make the kid go, and when you get that view, you'll get a wide view of everything. And be sure to decide ahead of time, are you going to move your head to the left or to the right to avoid the vomit if that kid ends up wanting to puke on you? It's a terrible mean thing that we do as pediatricians multiple times a day, and we just kind of go on with our lives.
Yeah, I think if you can't see anything when you open the mouth, you've got to take a look. You've got to compress the tongue. You've got to get a gag to see it. The one thing I've learned over my career, and I've actually changed, you know, we say, open up and say, ah, that sounds like a, I forgot what album that was.
Brian, that would be Open Up and Say Ah by the American glam metal band Poison, released in 1988 with hits such as Nothing But a Good Time, Fallen Angel, and Yo Mama Don't Dance. Now, don't ever say that we here at AZMCast aren't incredibly thorough with researching and referencing all of our material. Wikipedia.
I actually have the patients say, blah. And blah actually depresses the posterior tongue a little bit. So it's better. Try this for yourself. Try them to say ah. Try them to say blah. You'll get a couple more that you can see before you have to gag them. So it's a nice way if you're not feeling like being vomited on. But then if they, you still can't see it, go ahead and get a good look.
I've also had them yawn. I find you get a pretty good look if you have people yawn, because no one wants to actually say ah. You say ah, and they open their mouth. I'm like, I didn't say open your mouth. I said say ah. This is classic doctor stuff. Like, just do what the doctor says. I said ah. Ah. So we're going to take a look at the tonsils. We're going to look for things like palatal petechiae. We're going to look for exudates. I've had patients just kind of swish around some water or something if I'm not sure if it's an exudate or not. These things are not as great as you might think for being able to predict strep throat. That's the one that everybody's kind of after. We'll talk about that one at the end. But palatal petechiae, strep throat, exudates, all of these kind of Centaur criteria, they're all right, but they really only approach about 80 to 90% sensitivity. So you're still going to miss a fair amount of these if you hone in on this. Other things that you want to be looking at while you're in the throat, you want to be looking at the neck itself, is the neck supple. And that's a word that I think we write down a lot but don't really think about. If you grab on the neck, is it squishy like a neck? Can you kind of feel around and feel lymph nodes? Can you feel the trachea? Is the trachea mobile and makes this noise when you shake it back and forth? John Sackles has told me that patients with tracheitis, with epiglottitis, with stuff in their airway will not open their mouth and point when you ask them where it hurts. They will point directly at their neck. And so that's been helpful for me as well when I talk to people and say, where does it hurt? If they go, and they point to the back of their throat, well, then I'm worried more about pharyngitis versus somebody who points at their neck. I'm worried they have more of an airway issue. You want to feel under the tongue for any woodiness, for any swelling under there that might make you think of a deep space neck infection. And then you want to get range of motion of the neck. Can they lift their neck up and down, flexion, extension, left and right? If they can do all those things, even if it's with pain, but they can still do it, it's probably going to be your garden variety pharyngitis.
Yeah. And you're going to look at how they're sitting, too. I think as you walk in the room, you'll see, we'll talk about some of the sicker patients. They're not going to want to lay back. They may have a rigid neck sitting forward, almost in their own sniffing position to help them breathe in the super sick ones. I agree with Aaron. I palpate both the trachea and I move it back and forth because also to see it elicitate, right? If they have any pain with that motion, that's a different person and it's not making that grinding sound that it normally should make. So that's going to key you in. Maybe there's a deep space infection. Maybe there's a tracheitis going on in there. Other things I think you should comment on is the uvula. Is the uvula midline? Is it deviated to one side or the other? Is there any peritonsillar fullness? Is there on one side or the other? Is there a retropharyngeal bulge, like the back of the pharynx seems to be coming closer? You know, what are the size of the tonsils? Are they big, small? Are they absent because they've had a tonsillectomy? You know, these are some common things that you want to put in your exam and you're noting when you're looking at the patient as well. But this doesn't take long, right? This is a good oral pharynx exam. It really is not a long time for you to do. So just take a good look, couple palpation, have them say, get a good view, and you'll be in good shape.
I think the last thing that you may notice and be surprised at sometimes is you see a giant punching bag hanging in the back of their throat and go, oh, this might be something like Quincke's disease or something that's a little more angioedema. We had a girl come in the other day, complained of sore throat in the midst of a ton of sore throats, and she mentioned offhand in her family history was hereditary angioedema. And by the way, I have this huge bag of medications that my doctor says if I ever feel this, I'm supposed to get injected, but I have no idea how. So we said, all right, well, let's boogie then. Let's get some stuff going. So 50% of what you're going to see with these sore throats are going to be viral. And then the rest are going to be some kind of either bacterial, environmental, you're dehydrated, you've been puffing on too many e-cigs or whatever it is that you've been doing that's causing this irritation. But the sore throat is such a wastebasket complaint with so many different things we could lump into it that we're going to start with the bad things that you have to find first. I think probably the worst one that we could start with is Ludwig's angina.
Yeah, Ludwig's angina, in a sense, it's Fournier's of the neck. So you think
that's
of it.
That's the most disgusting thing I can think of. Right. Terrible, terrible description. Just accurate.
Right. It's, you know, I guess it's a different kind of dangling thing, but we'll stay away from that. Fournier's, you know, so this Ludwig's angina, right? It's a necrotizing infection of the neck, usually starting, we think, from dental infections or a common cause where it starts to erode down, and you start to get they'll present with this swollen front part of the neck, so maybe below their chin and mandible, there's this swelling, more so than what you would expect in that patient. Sometimes if you look in the mouth, there's this like elevation of the floor of the mouth under the tongue, and it's just because of all that significant swelling. So you do want to look under the tongue in these patients as well. Because this, you can see air sometimes if you do it on x-ray, you may feel some crepitus, but it may just be significant swelling. And if you're worried about this, like in any of these significant airway, ENT infections, you need to worry about the airway. Treatment's usually going to be a penicillin and flagyl, a lot of anaerobes here, and then you're going to want to talk to your ear, nose, and throat doctor, be worried about a debridement, and they're going to be admitted to the ICU.
Yeah, we're generally going to be able to see this because it's a necrotizing infection with air on just one of the soft tissue neck x-rays. This is something that's pretty easy to pick up, and if you see air in that space, you should be a little bit more concerned. These these people often come in with like a bullfrog neck. They're people that have a hoarse voice. They're people that feel like they're in distress. Something awful is happening to me right now, and it's not just your average sore throat. These are usually people with very, very poor dentition, because oropharyngeal flora is going to be your source, or maybe you've got a penetrating injury. We had a little kid with a coat hanger that got stuck in the floor of the mouth that developed an infection. Didn't make it to a full Ludwig's angina where it went all the way down the neck, but that was certainly the concern, and we prophylaxed that kid to make sure it didn't get anywhere. So you're going to be aiming for treatment of oropharyngeal flora, and then absolutely if you have any concerns about airway, debride that, secure that so that ENT can debride it. And sometimes if this goes low enough, the angina component is because this can make its way all the way down to the mediastinum. And if it gets into the mediastinum, now you need ENT and cardiothoracic surgery to tag team this, and that's not a very fun day. I've had that happen once. We saw this poor guy. Matt Berkman took excellent care of him. Very difficult intubation in a guy with a real woody induration to his neck. Got him intubated, got him over and debrided, and the guy did well. Remember, antibiotics are going to help a little bit, but really this is an operative emergency. Right. So the antibiotics come up. What do you get first? You get antibiotics on board, or do you call your ear, nose, and throat doc? You call your definitive treatment surgeon in order to get them on board early to prep an OR and do all their stuff, and then the antibiotics might slow stuff down a little bit. So moving right along with big, dangerous sore throats, epiglottitis. You will see 1,000 subarachnoid hemorrhages before you see one pediatric epiglottitis. We have done a really, really good job of vaccinating this out of kids. In fact, I took a kind of an informal poll of our intensive care doctors, our ear, nose, and throat doctors, our EM doctors, and really no one who finished their training after about 1990 has ever seen a pediatric epiglottitis. That's how good we've gotten at eradicating H flu. So even though you're not going to see this in kids, you will see this in adults. I've seen 3 or 4 epiglottitis in adults.
I think, yeah, about the same.
Yeah. So this is going to be, in kids, it's classically going to be Haemophilus influenza. And the way they'll describe this kid on a test is this will be a kid who has sudden onset over the course of maybe hours, like a couple hours. They look toxic. They're drooling. They're stridulous. They're holding their neck in the sniffing position, and they look sick. So adults don't tend to have that rapid progression because their stuff tends more to be kind of the strep pneumo, MSSA, even MRSA sometimes. It's a different epidemiology, so they're going to present a little bit differently.
Yeah, they, it seems to usually present, the ones I've seen, it's usually a couple days. You know, sore throat, it kind of hurt when they swallow, and maybe their voice changed a little bit. And then it hits that threshold where they're having difficulty breathing. Whether they wake up at night with shortness of breath because they can't, they're basically, you know, drowning themselves from big floppy tissue, or, you know, they're just trying to exert themselves, or during the day, it just, it hits a point and they're like, I can't do this anymore, and they come in. So they're coming in at a significant advancement of the disease, and it's not something that they've had before, nor do they know about, because they can't see it in the back of their throat. Some of these people have been treated with antibiotics, maybe for a sore throat, but it still can progress. So you got to be worried in the shortness of breath patient, even though they may not say sore throat, they may just present as the adult with shortness of breath and come in, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, and the family's distraught because they can't breathe. And so now you're thinking, oh, well, you're a 50-year-old guy, you know, maybe it's a PE, maybe it's a, you know, pneumothorax, I don't know what's going on, and you start doing chest x-rays, but think about the throat in these older adults.
And the two things that these patients almost universally have on their exam, one of them is they'll have a funny voice. These are the hot potato voices. Can you do a hot potato voice?
I don't know. If it's something like this. It is sort of a little, it is off, just enough.
Because there's this swelling around their cords. The second thing I've almost always seen, or at least I have always seen in my patients, is they do not want to lay down.
Correct.
So you are thinking, maybe they got a PE, and you send them to the scanner, and they don't want to lay down, you say, it's okay, just relax, here's some Ativan, and suddenly you've got a crack in the CT scanner. So you can diagnose this from x-rays, although I have seen far more overcalled epiglottitis on lateral neck films that were just not shot well, especially in children, compared to times that I've had it correctly diagnosed on an x-ray. You can do a CT, but again, these patients don't like to be laid down. Really, this is a good clinical diagnosis or somebody that you take a look with a scope. If you're in a place where you can't take a look with a scope and you have worries about these patients, then maybe you need to send them to a place, or maybe you need to consider, if they're sick, intubating them. There's always a big concern about intubating epiglottitis. You need to have ear, nose, and throat ready, and you need to have anesthesia ready, and you need to have your Cryte kit ready, and all this stuff is ready before you intubate. But if you're in a place that has nothing, and you're the only person, you are the most experienced person to intubate, then you got to make that decision. And I was talking with Nicola Baker the other day, who's one of our new faculty, the graduate of ours, who said everybody told her, oh, wow, it must be amazing to work in a rural center. These critical access hospitals must be so, like, scary. She goes, no, I know I can only do what I can do. So in some ways, it's a little more freeing rather than having subspecialists breathe down your back about why didn't you do this correctly.
So I think really doing the lateral neck is the best x-ray or the best starting point for this. So shoot a lateral neck, and this is not a C-spine neck, this is a soft tissue neck, and you're looking for a thumbprint sign. The thumbprint sign is just saying that there's a swollen epiglottis that is now in the trachea that you're seeing on that lateral neck x-ray. That's the best thing that you're going to look for there. And if you still have a question, I agree with Aaron, you need to probably scope these patients. And whether ENT does it or you can do it, you know, we can do this at bedside. Now, I wouldn't go through the mouth. I would go through the nose on these patients. Now, they're not going to like going through the nose, but you don't want to gag them or interrupt them in any way. And a lot of times going down through the nose, you're not looking necessarily to intubate. The first thing you're looking to do is just look at the epiglottis. You are just doing a quick look to see what you can see. Then you come up with your next plan. So you don't have to worry like, well, I don't have an intubating, you know, endoscope. Most people have a scope of some kind to take a look. If you don't have that, it's hard to confirm. I would still treat these patients with antibiotics, steroids, fluid resuscitation, and then try to get them to somewhere that can take a look. And if need to, like Aaron said, you're going to secure the airway. Sometime on your lateral neck x-ray, I've had cases where it has been, you can't see the epiglottis, the trachea comes down and stops. That's concerning as well. So you may not see the thumbprint sign, but if you're seeing that...
You see a blind-ended trachea, which is also problematic.
If you see the blind end of the trachea, assume it's epiglottitis, and again, antibiotics, steroids, and obviously these patients get admitted to the ICU. They don't all need to be intubated.
Correct.
But they do need to, in a sense, get the antibiotics because this is a cellulitis of the epiglottis. Usually it doesn't require, there's usually not an abscess, so the ENT is not going to drain this or cut on your epiglottis or surgically remove the epiglottis. They're just going to watch it and maintain the airway.
Yeah, classically, the reason why you have ear, nose, and throat involved on these epiglottitis cases in kids is because they were the experts at doing pediatric airway stuff. And I question, I'll insert my own turkey right here, whether newly trained peds ENT docs would be any better than anybody else at this point, except that they're just comfortable working in that area. So to give a quick nod to what we used to do, they used to have epiglottitis teams. And when you suspected epiglottitis, the first thing you would do is nothing. And this is still true for like pediatric airway foreign body. Those kids do a better job of protecting their airways than you will. And so the first thing you do is nothing. You don't touch them. You don't put an IV in them. You don't get a blood pressure. You don't put the pulse ox on their toe. You don't take them away from mom or dad. You put them in a dark room and you let them protect their airway. And outside of the room, you get everything ready for that kid to crash. You get your IO drill. You get your needle crike. You get all of your airway toys. You start calling ENT. You call anesthesia. You call pediatric ICU. You say, here's what I got. And the plan is going to be ENT is going to take him to the operating room because they're the experts on cutting on the neck in kids. And if they mask this kid down and then the kid has an event, ENT is ready to do that intervention. But maybe ENT can get them intubated as well. So. Yeah. For regardless of who it is, in this day and age, it's just almost never going to be a kid. So for these 40-year-old men that come in with epiglottitis, which is kind of the age group we're seeing now, which is not that far away from children, for
right.
most of us. So
I still act like a child.
Yeah. You want to give them some antibiotics, usually cefuroxime, ceftriaxone, that'll work. Dexamethasone to try to help with airway edema, and then send them up to the ICU. So croup is going to be another kind of sore throat type thing that can turn into bacterial tracheitis. It's not really a sore throat, though, because that's not what parents will present with. They won't come in and say, my child's throat is sore. Do they happen to have a seal-like cough? You know, now that you mention it, it does sound like a seal. They're going to come in with cough. But bacterial tracheitis is, if you've got more in adults, you've got that viral infection that then gets a bacterial superinfection on top of it. So this is, again, something that you'll see in kids, but the sore throat complaint is going to be more of an adult thing.
Right. And this is a really rare disease. I was looking at a study, and it said about in 14 years, they only saw 34 cases of bacterial tracheitis. So this is something that's pretty rare. And it may present with just a, you know, maybe sore throat, maybe cough, maybe a little stridor, looks like croup, or, you know, just a laryngitis of some kind that's kind of brewing for a couple days. And then all of a sudden, they get worse. The super sick ones make...
All of a sudden.
Right, all of a sudden.
Really quickly.
And they go downhill. And so a small percentage may be super sick right away, but all of a sudden they just look toxic and nasty. You're trying to give them steroids, you're trying to give them racemic epi, they're not improving. That's your red flag. Maybe something else is going on. And they're not improving with this because now there's a debris and junk that's now in their airway and starting to slough. And so it's not just the mucosal inflammation that the steroids and the racemic epi may help with to help open up that airway and give them a little more room to breathe. This is now like junk and nastiness that you really can't get out with just some medicines.
So for kids, you can see that this is one of the few times where I'd say a lateral neck may help you because you're now expanding your differential to, is this epiglottitis? Is this bacterial tracheitis? Is this an airway foreign body? For general garden variety croup, you don't need an x-ray. You need an x-ray when you're trying to say it's not croup. For adults, again, this may be helpful, maybe not, but it's not going to be that big of a differentiator. You may see their steeple sign, which is a lot more classically shown for kids. This is also going to be a case where you're going to treat for your sinus kind of flora, your strep pneumo. The bacterial tracheitis I saw was a Moroxella, and then staph strep kind of stuff as well. When you actually take a look, you'll see very swollen edematous cords, and you may just want to put a tube through that.
Yeah, and the, you know, really the diagnosis will be made on someone directly visualizing the trachea. You could do a CT scan, but that's not going to really show you the answer.
And you're not going to want to lay down.
So a lot of these things, we may talk about CTs, the diagnosis, but the other diagnosis is going to be direct visualization, whether it's looking in the back of throat or using a scope looking down the throat.
I mean, really, CT is just kind of a non-surgeon's way to look at what a surgeon would typically look at. So
right.
If you can get a good look, that's actually preferable
better.
To a CT in a lot of ways. So bacterial tracheitis versus epiglottitis on a test is going to be a kid who starts out with croup-like symptoms, has a viral prodrome for a couple of days, and then suddenly gets worse and looks like epiglottitis. But they've got that history of a viral prodrome. You are more likely to see this than you are to see epiglottitis nowadays. anyways.
Right.
Peripheringial peritonsil abscess, you are definitely going to see. So a peritonsil abscess is going to be that patient that comes in. It feels like for us, it's always about 19 to 25-year-olds that come in with these peritonsil abscess.
Yeah, younger adults, not kids, not really old adults, right. Young adults.
And then younger kids, like school-aged kids. Mm-hmm. So this is thought to be one of the separative complications of strep pharyngitis. And then once we drain it and we put them on antibiotics, we treat for everything, including strep pharyngitis. But we say, well, just in case it's not what we classically think it is, let's just bomb them with everything. So these kids will come in. They'll have sore throat, typical sore throat symptoms that you would see, maybe a day or two of symptoms. And then they'll start to have, depending on the age, just really bad sore throat. They'll have a muffled voice. They may have that hot potato voice as well, mm-hmm. because it hurts to actually move their pharynx. And when you look, if you take a good look, you're going to see they're swollen on one side versus the other. Brian, have you ever seen a bilateral peritonsil abscess?
Yes.
Really?
I have.
I've never seen one.
I've seen one, but it was brewing for a while.
Okay.
So it slowly progressed, and one side was definitely bigger than the other side. But yeah, the thought of it, this is like a triple ear infection. It's really rare to get a triple ear infection. I mean, I've heard of these double ear infections. Most kids have them all the time. I see it on Facebook too.
Yeah. It was a double ear infection. Yeah. Both barrels.
Both barrels. Full on.
So the peritonsil abscess, one of the big differentiating factors that I like to figure this out is they can't open their mouth. They have trismus, where you tell them to open their mouth and they open it about 2 millimeters and say, is that good enough? No, it's not. And it makes sense. I always remember that it's a peritonsil abscess because I need to get my needle and my light and my ultrasound probe and everything else in there, and I can't because it hurts too bad. So as with all of the oropharyngeal stuff, you want to direct it at oropharyngeal flora. So I think we mentioned this already, that really one of the antibiotics that you can throw at pretty much everybody is going to be amoxicillin clavulanic acid, or you can do ampicillin sulbactam. If you don't have that, you can use clindamycin. But we pretty much throw that at all of these infections, and they're probably going to stick.
Right. And the nice part is you can do that IV. There's also a liquid form, and then because a lot of these patients may not want to swallow pills given they have a lot of pain, so just consider that. You get the IV dose and then it's easy to convert. Peritonsil abscesses, you know, with this progression, there's some point that's going to trigger them. So it's going to be a gag, it's going to be I can't swallow, they're going to have these voice changes. When you have all these things, really get a good look. And so one of the things, I look in the back of the throat, but another technique I was taught by ENT is to, as Aaron said, trismus is one thing. Another thing is tenderness in the peritonsillar space. So you can't just take your finger and stab it right back in the back of the throat and do that. But one of the tricks you can do is open your mouth and then open their mouth. Don't open your mouth while you're
both.
We could open your mouth. Hi, look at me. I'm opening my mouth.
You stick your finger in my mouth and I'll stick my finger in your mouth.
Oh, that's a patient complaint right there. So what you do is you take your finger and you slide it along the cheek of the side that you want to go in. And you slide it along the cheeks. And in a sense, what you're doing is desensitizing. And then you bring it around back by the molars and then touch that peritonsillar space. And check both sides to see if there's any tenderness. So tenderness is indicative of an infection. And remember, this is a spectrum from cellulitis to abscess, right? So patients don't just develop the abscess right away. You can have a peritonsillar cellulitis, right? You have someone, they have maybe some muffled sounds. They can open their mouth a little bit bigger. You ultrasound them. You don't see anything in the peritonsillar space, but it's fuller than the other side. Maybe they're tender. I would still treat them with Augmentin, knowing that
everybody knows what I was talking about when I said amoxicillin clavulanic acid.
So, but you would treat them for a cellulitis in that case. But those are the things that you're going to want to do in your approach to this. I've actually had a peritonsillar abscess when I was a new attending here at 35, so it was miserable.
And again, Brian is just a large child.
I am a total large child. I was playing the sandbox the other day with Mike Mudd. It's wonderful. So I had this, and I knew when I needed to go in because I had a sore throat for 5 days. And then one night, I gagged at 2 a.m. in the morning, and I could not lay down, and I had to sit forward, and I actually had my wife drive me in because I was worried I was going to vomit on the way in because I was gagging so much. But I got steroids and some antibiotics, and they took care of me and ultrasounded, tried to aspirate, couldn't get anything out, and so just watched me for a little bit and then sent me home. The next day I felt great because I had the steroids and a single dose of antibiotics. I was chasing pack rats around the yard, and my wife thought I was absolutely nuts. But then the next morning it was still full, and I was like, I need to go back in. So I went back in, got a bunch of drugs. So I've experienced fentanyl, morphine, Dilaudid. They all work. It's wonderful.
This is all coming together now from your clinical practice.
So I went back in, and the ENT did a drainage, and so I went upstairs to their clinic, and they aspirated, and so did a small aspiration. And then he said, now this is really going to suck. And he took the blade and he stuck it in the back of the throat. And he said, now this is really going to suck, Brian. And he took the hemostat and he went in and opened it up. And there's nothing like tasting that bouquet of pus and blood going down the back of your throat. And just, you know, it's just a beautiful, beautiful taste. You can only taste it once to really have it cement in your mind. So, and I sat there for 30 minutes and was just spitting, and then went home and recovered and felt better. So obviously, I changed my practice a little bit with this too. So my approach to peritonsillar abscess, like Aaron was alluding to, is you got to drain these, right? Some places ENT drains it, and just some ERs they don't drain this at all. I think it's in our practice, and we should know how to do it, and I think it's doable. I don't think you need to be worried about it. The first thing I do is I actually get a Mac blade, an 11 blade, or not an 11 blade, a Mac blade, a 4, put it on a laryngoscope, and that becomes your light source. You slide that in the back of the mouth. Now this is all after you've numbed them. What's the best numbing technique for the back of the throat? I've have them gargled like viscous lidocaine. I've had them do nebulized lidocaine. You know, some people have John Sackles has this like cream. I don't know what 5% it's called.
5% lidocaine cream. Yeah, you put that on one of the sponge sticks and you have them hold it right there. That works really well.
Yeah. So you want to topically anesthetize it as best you can, and then please give these patients pain medicine before you start doing this procedure because it's not fun. So after that, you put the Mac blade in, take a look, and then you're going to take some, I like to use Lido with Epi because this is a bloody area, and so I'll use that as my anesthetic, but I'll look with the ultrasound first. And why do I look with the ultrasound first? One, it tells me where the carotid is and how deep I can go. Two, it actually tells me if there's a pocket of pus. So I've had patients where if I don't see a pocket of pus on there or a fluid collection, I'll actually treat them with antibiotics, have them come back in a couple days, and we'll relook at it. And sometimes it accumulates, the pus is there, and so you drain it the next day, just like you would a normal abscess. So you take a look.
I had this discussion just the other day with this girl who was sent over for a peritonsillar abscess, and I took the endocavitary probe, and I took a look and found this little half a centimeter by 1 centimeter abscess, and I said, you have pus. I will promise you that in 3 chances, which is really all I give myself, I will not get that. Let's try some antibiotics.
Yeah.
She was very happy about that plan.
Which is, it's totally reasonable. I mean, this is similar to our wound antibiotics that we're doing for abscess cellulitis, kind of that spectrum of disease. So after you find the area, anesthetize it, and then I like to go in with a needle and aspirate it. Now, some people, I used to do the whole, like, cut off the plastic. plastic tip of the needle, so you only will go so deep. But this is the beauty of ultrasound. If you've measured the depth of where you're going to the carotid and your abscess cavity is 3 centimeters, not many of us have a needle that's 3 centimeters long that we're going to hub in the back of the throat. And what you're really doing is you're aspirating as you're going, trying to pull out some pus. And once you find that, suck out as much pus as you can. And a lot of people will stop there. They feel comfortable with aspiration. You get out as much as you can. Maybe try a couple different angles. Get as much as you can. Some people, you know, I was taught at one point to just, well, if you keep poking, you've now created a bunch of drains that now all the pus will come out through these 15 holes you put in the back of their mouth. But after, you know, having this learning that once I aspirate it, I will go in with an 11 blade down the same track and punch it through once, and then I'll go with the hemostat and do a quick opening and trying to get the pus out. And I found that that's been pretty good and actually getting good results in patients. Their swelling goes down on repeat exam in an hour after they're chilling out after the procedure. You know, they feel a lot better. Their voice improves really fast. The more pus you can get out of these patients, I think the better.
Yeah, one of the things they always tell you for your tests, make sure you don't accidentally hit big red, don't hit the carotid. The easiest way to make sure you don't hit the carotid is just travel right along the angle of the jaw. So go right down the molars and head straight for that peritonsillar space. Remember, this is not a tonsillar abscess. It's not an abscess in the tonsil. It's a peritonsillar abscess. It's above. Next to the tonsil, okay? So you want to aim next to it, a little bit above, then a little bit lateral, and then somewhere in between above and lateral diagonally. And as you step down, as long as you go through, you'll be fine. I still do the cut the tip off the spinal needle, not because I'm worried I'm going to have it, but I'm worried that patient's going to go and then lurch at me or something, because I don't trust patients to sit still when I'm jabbing them in the back of the mouth. And then ultrasound is great. I've seen people try to cram an ultrasound probe and a needle and a medical student's finger and all kinds of stuff inside these poor patients' mouths. I find that maybe in my population, they have smaller mouths and you can't fit all this stuff. So I do an ultrasound to get a measurement, and then I go in and do it blind. That's usually my approach. However, ultrasound definitely makes this practice better.
I do the same thing. I've only been able to do, I think, one or two patients with the ultrasound because it's just, you get too much in the mouth. One thing, if you're able to get a little bit of pus out, sometimes the next approach, they can open up a little bit more, right? You have a marble or golf ball in the back of their throat, you can't open up. So just, try it the next time, maybe. And I will actually ultrasound after I'm done, too, to show that, oh, there's this pocket of fluid, now it's no longer there.
Now, most procedures in the ER, you need a cooperative patient. So if you have a kid who has a peritonsillar abscess, you can't ultrasound it because they're going to not let you. You're not going to be able to ultrasound it from the cutaneous approach. So these patients, unfortunately, are usually going to need a CAT scan. They're going to need to be admitted, IV dexamethasone, antibiotics, ENT consult to do in the OR. It's the humane thing to do. Yeah. So don't feel like you have to muscle down a 3-year-old to try to stab them.
I think I've only done it in adults that I've trained. I don't know about you, Aaron.
No, I've only ever done adults. I've had peritonsillar abscesses on one side. I've never had them on both sides, but I have had peritonsillar abscesses that have stretched along to the back and become retropharyngeal abscesses because they got so big. And a retropharyngeal abscess is going to be different. Generally, you're not going to get what I just described. You're going to have some kind of local intrusion, local trauma that is going to cause a pus in the prevertebral space. And what this will do, in contrast to the peritonsillar abscess, who won't open their mouth, a retropharyngeal abscess will make it so that the patient doesn't want to move their neck. So they'll hold their neck in one position, usually the one that's the most patent, and they will leave it there. So if you say, hey, look over here, they'll look with their eyes, but they won't move their head. And they'll be very, very still. Children will, as long as they find a happy position, will play and they'll watch TV, but they will not move their neck. That has to make you very suspicious because a retropharyngeal abscess abscess can track down into the chest and become something bad. A retropharyngeal abscess can progress and cause airway obstruction. And a retropharyngeal abscess absolutely needs to be drained because it's pus. These are not ones that are commonly going to get better with just antibiotics. In fact, in the patients that I suspect it and then I get a CT and it's just a cellulitis, I still tend to admit those kids when they're young because that can turn south in a hurry.
Yeah, and these are abscesses you're not draining. This is an ENT would be doing the drainage for this. The kids I've had with this, like Aaron said, they're just sitting forward. They're not moving. They usually have a fever. And sometimes they complain of neck pain more than sore throat. So it may be a different chief complaint that you're seeing, but you got to think about it in these kids. You're going to get the fluids on board. You're going to treat them as a deep space infection with IV antibiotics as well. And I usually put these kids into the ICU as well. Again, a lot of these upper, sore throat, or excuse me, upper neck or lower neck infections can affect the airway. So a lot of times you're going to have to manage them in the ICU, even though they're not truly getting, drips and pressors and they're not intubated, but it's an observation that you don't want to put this kid on the floor.
Yeah, the alternative from putting them in the ICU where they have a 1-to-1 or 1-to-2 nurse to patient ratio is putting them on the floor where they have a 1-to-6 patient ratio. Mm-hmm. And that may not be a good idea unless you can get them to the OR first. Even after that, they probably want to be watched for a while because of their airway. So this is really a clinical diagnosis followed by a CT scan. You can do an X-ray in these kids, and typically what I was taught is that if the prevertebral space, so the space in front of the vertebrae, anterior to it, is greater than half the width of the vertebrae that you're in front of, then you should be concerned. This can really easily be thrown off by having a kid in poor position. These kids are supposed to be in the sniffing position with their neck up, chin tucked out, and their airway patent. If you have a kid whose neck is curled down toward their chest, then you can falsely widen that space, and then you're kind of stuck.
Yeah, if you see it like it, and usually we do the measurements in kids and adults at C2 or C3, if that space is the full width of your vertebral body, that's concerning, even in a kid that has flexion. But you have to note the flexion component. And if it's double the size of that vertebral body, I would consider that real. In adults, we look at like C2 would be 6 millimeters, and at C6 would be 22 millimeters, looking for these spaces. So next one we're going to talk about is parapharyngeal abscess. So now we have a peritonsillar abscess. We've had a retropharyngeal abscess. Now we're having a parapharyngeal. So right along the side of the pharynx. And this a lot of times is also caused by dental infections, maybe a tonsillitis, maybe mastoiditis, but some bacterial infection that now is spreading in that parapharyngeal space. These will also present with fever. Maybe it's a rapid onset or progressive over a couple days, but this isn't going to be brewing for like weeks to months. They may have swelling of their lateral neck. So again, they may not come in with sore throat. They may feel, hey, my lateral neck, I got this bump in my lateral neck, or I got a swollen neck or something like that. And that's what their chief complaint is. And what you're going to want to feel on exam, you're going to feel for areas that you can't, I can't see the mandible where it turns in. I can't feel that submandibular gland. So if you're seeing a fullness there, that's something you should be concerned about. Depending on where it goes, they may have trismus, they may have difficulty swallowing, they could be in respiratory distress if this gets too bad. And a lot of these, you're not going to be able to directly visualize it. You're going to have to do a CT scan. Now, because of the location, the parapharyngeal space, a lot of times they can lay down because it's not the epiglottis that's swollen. It's not, an upper airway, a peritonsillar abscess that's pushing across the upper pharynx and closing off their airway. So because it's the lateral side of the neck, a lot of times they can lay down. You get your CT scan. You see it, then you call ENT. You're going to do your same IV antibiotics, IV fluids. Sometimes they drain them. Sometimes they watch them, give some antibiotics, and see if they need to drain them. A lot of these patients will be admitted. Not all will be going to the ICU. Sometimes, if it's mild, they can send them to the floor. Again, a little less airway compromise in this disease. Sometimes you can get this complication called Lemierre's disease, which is, in a sense, a septic thrombophlebitis. So the internal jugular vein. You don't get it with every parapharyngeal abscess, but it's associated with this disease.
So let's recap real quick. So big bad things that you'll see on a test. Ludwig's angina is going to be a dental infection that has progressed downward. They'll have pain and fullness on the floor of the mouth, under the tongue. They're going to have a woody induration of their neck, and it's Fournier's gangrene of the neck. Still disgusting. Epiglottitis on the test is going to be a kid who was well and previously, and then suddenly, within hours, had the onset of fever, drooling, stridor, and looks toxic. Bacterial tracheitis is going to be a kid that had some URI symptoms, maybe a barky cough over the course of a day or two, and then suddenly got sicker because they have a bacterial superinfection. Parapharyngeal abscess is going to be that fullness on one side or the other. That means that you need to actually take a pretty good look at these patients and look for this asymmetry. One of the other things I found to be confounder with this is kids or adults that have peritonitis, where their parotid gland is inflamed and it hangs down, or maybe a cervical lymph node.
And a bunch of cervical lymph nodes that create a large swollen neck will also look like a parapharyngeal abscess. So sometimes you see TM and they're just like, oh, it's a bunch of lymph nodes.
And then retropharyngeal abscess is going to be generally trauma to the back of the throat, won't want to move their neck, they'll have neck stiffness, and then a peritonsillar abscess will be a sequelae of some other kind of throat infection with trismus, where they won't want to open their mouth. And then probably the last one we'll talk about is diphtheria.
Yeah, we should spend a lot of time on diphtheria.
You'll see 1,000 pediatric epiglottitis before you see a case of diphtheria. Okay? We're not going to talk about diphtheria.
Yay, vaccines. We love vaccines.
Whatever you do, don't suck the membrane out yourself with a straw. That's all the advice I have for diphtheria.
Yeah.